This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last week we talked about the book of Matthew Asurim, the idea that we don't have to be energized in the morning. All we have to do is undo the inhibitors. The energy is within us. And if we simply untie ourselves, then we can move and we can become alive and active. When we talked about the whole idea of being stuck in things, the different things that we are stuck in, what it is that causes us to be stuck, but it's usually internal, not external factors. And if it's internal, it means we have the resources within ourselves to unstick ourselves. And we use the idea of awakening, of our inversion, once again, as the vehicle, as one of the mechanisms of awakening ourselves. And that being the idea of sensing a vision, not just thinking or formulating a vision in one's mind, but feeling what it's like. And we looked at feeling what the vision is like on all the four different levels of aliveness, as we called it. The physical level, the level of sensing, of sensation, which is the good. The level of energy, of nefesh, of vitality. The area of relationship, of ruach, and the area of purpose and meaning, which is mashallah, and those are the four different areas of human existence, and how we need to feel vital in all of those areas and access that sense of vitality to provide us with the sensation of activity. Remember we talked about the mind experiment, how it was the feeling of the saccharine more than the damage to their immune system that got them replicating the illness. And if that applies to the negative, it applies also to the positive, that we're able to energize ourselves enormously by sensations that we associate with achievement and with accomplishment and with vitality and with being alive. And we have to, that's our means, we're going to take that much further today, that's our means of energizing ourselves. Our means of energizing ourselves is in fact to create within us the sensation, a positive sensation, because a positive sensation allows us to move in the direction of that sensation. So usually we consider sensation to be the outcome of events, and that is so for the animal world, but in our world sensation is the cause of events, and that's what makes us human. We can create sensation. Anybody who reads a newspaper will know that that's possible. We can create sensation, and then intellect and everything follows the sensation. It's not the other way around. It's not that sensation is created, it's not that there's an event is created and then sensation follows it. Sensation creates the event. And so it is in every aspect of our life. We can use sensation to create an event which afterwards draws our involvement and our energy. And in the awakening sense, we create the moment of awakening, we create the sensation of awakening, we create the sensation of vitality, of an energetic, alive day ahead of us, and that gathers all our forces together and makes us active and makes us move. Are there any questions or difficulties on last week's shiur before we go a step further? Now, once again, the style of this shiur is very different from, certainly from my usual ones, and we will not. These are not textual analyses, and they're not complicated structures. We're trying to get right away from that kind of left brain activity and become far more involved in the sensation, in the feeling of the substance that we're trying to understand, that we're trying to grasp. It was interesting that a couple of people came up to me after last week's shiur and another shiur and said things I've never heard people say after my shiurim so much before. Usually when somebody comes after a shiur, they have a question on something I said, or they have a question on a text I used, or they don't understand some connection that I made. I've had a number of people coming to after and saying, I don't, there's something about myself I can't understand. And that's great, that's exactly right. If the shiur is causing us to question ourselves, then it is 100% successful. It doesn't matter what you've understood or haven't understood, or whether you can meditate or you can't, or you get it or you don't. If you go away questioning yourself, then we're in the process of change, then we're in the process of awakening. So rather than be questioning the material, what's important is questioning yourself and sensing it yourself. So let's go a little bit further. Now we're free. So we've woken up, we've intuited ourselves, and we know what we are and what we're not, and we're not male, we're not female, we're not Jews, we're not Gentiles, and we're not slaves, we're free, all of those things we've got clear, we've been prepared to do, we've opened our eyes, we've seen, we've perceived with insight, and then we've used our minds to integrate and understand what we've seen. That's A, eyeing first, resh afterwards, first the eye, then the head. First sense, first feel, what do I feel? Not what should I feel, not what am I supposed to feel. You see, most civilians sometimes would say, here you must cry, here you must this, here you should feel this, here you should say with cover. That's not what we're talking about. It's not a question of what am I meant to be feeling. You're not meant to be feeling anything. What do you feel is what's important. What are you sensing? What are you perceiving? That's the A idea. Eyeing first. Have insight. See into yourself. See into the things around you. See. Use your insight. Eyeing doesn't just mean visual sight. Eyeing means insight. Use your insight. And then resh. When you perceive, when you've used your insight, internalize it, question it, analyze it, align it, do whatever you want with it. But don't allow your head to determine what you see, which is what we do most of the time. Our head filters what we see, because anything that doesn't fit into our paradigm is extremism of one sort or another, isn't it? So if it's to the right of us, then it's fundamentalism, and if it's to the left of us, it's reformation. So all we end up seeing is the things we're comfortable with. And on, we go through our lives seeing nothing but that which we're comfortable with. And A is not that. A means be awake, see what you're not comfortable with. Comfort is not aliveness. Aliveness is discomfort. Aliveness means you're sensing a disconnect between where you've been and where you are. If where you are is exactly where you've been, which is what comfort means. Comfort means where you are is where you've been. If where you are is where you've been, then where you'll be is where you are. Isn't that right? That's how it has to be. And the only being about whom that is truly true, that where you've been, where you are is where you've been, and therefore where you'll be is where you are, is a dead dog. That's not A. That's not being awake. Awake is, my goodness, where I am is where I've never been before. Where will I be tomorrow? That's awake. That's alive. That's A. But for that, you've got to have your eyes open, independent of your head, so that you can then bring your head in afterwards and not limit your insight by your mental paradigm. So we're awake, we're seeing, we've got insight, simulating. Now we're not even getting dressed yet, because we haven't said Matir Rasulim. It's quite a strange order of that. So we haven't said Matir Asurim, so we're kind of not out of bed yet, but we've already said Malbish Arumim, which is quite interesting. Why do you think that is? Why would we say the bracha for clothing before we've even released our bonds? We're still tied up in bed. Why are we saying a bracha for clothing? Based on last week's shiur, any ideas as to why that would be? Yeah, how do you get dressed before you've unbound yourself? Try it sometimes. Huh? Malbish Arumim in first and Matir Asurim in second.
You really have to be self-contained in how you bound this stuff to differentiate yourself with truth and what's not truth. Know what reality is. You have to know what absence of reality is. If you want to go outside of the cave and into the shadows, you have to know when you start the reality, you know, the limits of reality knowing your boundaries.
So yeah, so taking, excellent, yeah, so taking clothing, the broad sense as we did, as being the interface between yourself and the rest of the world, you need to know that there is such an interface, that there is a private way. When you wake up in the morning, you've been all private. You've been in your subconscious, you've been dreaming, you've been all private. Now you open your eyes, there's a public world out there. There's a real world, there's light streaming in, there's vision, there are people. You're hearing sounds, the phone might be ringing, the television might be on. Who knows what's going on, but there's action. All of a sudden, it's no longer private property, so we need the boundary. Before you can recover your private property, Malbish Arumim, they need that boundary to be able to create the private place. And the other idea might be just taking clothing in its natural, in its very literal sense, is that there's a need to picture yourself clothed before you can energize yourself to get into that clothing. Because the clothing is the role you're going to play during the day. The clothing is you in action. The clothing is you interfacing. So the work of Malbish Harim doesn't mean I'm getting dressed. It means I value, I appreciate the idea of clothing, of presentation, of projecting majesty, as we discussed it. Now that there's a certain confidence, I can see myself in the role I'm going to play today, now I can get up. Rather than, let me get up, and what do I feel like wearing? So the process is the opposite. Process starts. Who am I going to be today? So what am I going to wear? Well, then let me get up. It's a different kind of process. Try it tomorrow. It works quite interesting. So now we're ready to unbound. What's the next thing? So I want you to consider two pieces of furniture. Both of them designed for rest. One, a bed, and one, a chair. What's the Hebrew word for bed? Mita. What else does Mita mean? Yeah. Eh? No, Mita, that's mate with, but you're not far off. That's mate with a cup. Mita with a tet, but you're not far off. Mita means something else too. It means a beer.
A beer?
The thing you put a corpse on.
Uh-huh.
That's also called a Mita. What about a kise? A kise is a chair. What else is a kise? A throne. So you've got two items of furniture, both designed for leisure, both designed for rest. How many different species sit on chairs? Only the human being and God. So that kise hakovet, God's throne. It's the concept of chair applies to nothing or nobody, but God and human. Which means a chair, there's something divine about a chair. Have you ever thought of that? That there's something divine about a chair. Only God and humans use chairs. Whereas mita, a bed, that's a place of death. If you can't move, you're bound. Yes, it's leisure while you're asleep, it's fine. But when you're ready to get going, the mita is no longer the place. Lying in bed is no longer the place. Now you want to move into a different kind of a mode. So now I'm going to ask you to try something for a short while, just half a minute or so. I'm going to say to you, imagine for a moment, use your full powers of imagination, as hard as this might be for you. Imagine for a moment that the chair you're sitting on right now is a throne. And sit with the full impact of your own dignity on your throne. Close your eyes, imagine your chair is a throne, and sit with dignity. Just think of those words. Sit with dignity on your throne. Breathe in comfortably, nicely, for 30 seconds. Sit on your throne and sit with dignity, in a posture of dignity. Feel the way you're sitting and how it's different from the way you usually sit. Okay, very well done. Now what's interesting is, did you notice the amount of shifting in the room when I said sit with dignity? What does that mean? How were we sitting before? We were sitting without dignity, it must mean. Is that right? Because I said, well, sit with dignity, there was a lot of movement. That means before we were sitting without dignity. Why would a divine creature who has access to a throne used only by divine beings sit without dignity? What is the reason? No, dignity is not about other people looking. That's not what divine deals with, because we don't feel dignity. We don't feel dignified, that's all. We just don't feel dignified. And it's a very, very few times that we feel dignified. And when we do, it's usually when somebody's watching. But it's not that often that we feel dignified just because we're human. Just because of who and what we are. But that's what a kise is. A kise is a throne, a kise is a chair, it's a piece of furniture designed for the divine, on which one can rest in dignity. Because all other creatures, when they rest, they lose their dignity. When an animal rests, it has to lie down. It's low. It's flat. It's not powerful. It can't stand up for itself that quickly. It's to some degree vulnerable. Whereas the human being has the capacity to rest with a posture that retains their power, retains a sense of presence, retains a command, retains stature, and retains majesty. We can radiate majesty even when we're resting. Don't have to be standing up at attention in order to be radiating majesty. But we very seldom do that. Not only when we're sitting, we very seldom do that altogether. But certainly when we're sitting, we seldom do that because we seldom feel that. What part of your body is most present when you sat with dignity? Spine? Any other part? Alignment of shoulders? What else? What part did you use most of all to align yourself? Your core. You can't do it. Your core. Your stomach. Your sense of balance. It's your core. You will try again in a few moments and you'll see. As you're aligning yourself, in whatever posture you feel dignified, there's no rule for it. I'm not saying you must sit upright. Do it in any way you feel dignified. You're always sitting slightly different from one another, but there's a certain common denominator. The common denominator was a sense of alignment, a sense of integrity, a sense of things being together, a sense of presence. You weren't hiding from yourself. You were sitting as if you were proud to be around. And the fact that you had to move into a position of being proud to be around implies that most of the time we're sitting in a position in which we don't feel proud to be around. And there are lots of obvious reasons why we don't feel proud to be around. It's not because we're so bad. The reason we mostly don't feel proud to be around is because of the messages we're constantly getting from the world around us. But we're not meant to feel proud to be around, and we're constantly having to negate that. But it's that core that you feel. Just try it once again. You don't have to do it with your eyes closed. Just take your position of dignity on your throne and see what, just follow your limbs. Just see what you're doing to yourself when you take that position. What limbs are moving? What's changing? Where is your sense of centeredness? And you'll find your sense of centeredness is not your head. When you're sitting with dignity, it's not your head that changes and that waits and comes first. You want to balance your head in an upright sort of way. But it's all coming from the inside. It comes from your stomach. It comes from your core. Your spine, it's really the very center of your being that gets aligned in order to create that dignity. And so when we're talking about sitting in a posture of dignity, we're talking about, or standing for that matter, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference when you're standing or sitting. The beauty of sitting is that even in a resting position, we can be dignified. And we're the only ones that can. But to do so, we're using our core. Now to understand that a little bit further, we're going to look and play around, because this series is about playing with ideas. There's all the other series, I said it was a normal series, not much more serious. This one's about playing with ideas. And when you play with ideas, what happens when you play? What's the difference when a child's playing and when a child's in the classroom? There's no fear, you're free to try different things, you're open,
innovation.
You're innovative, you're creative. So one of the most important phases to be in, or modes to be in, when you're trying to access things in a different way, to try and be where you weren't before, so that you won't be tomorrow where you are today. And playing becomes very, very important. So to play with an idea, to play with it and see where it leads you and what it is. So the word for uprightness is? I show straight, upright is, anybody? Zakuf. Okay, the root is Zayin, Kuf, Pei. And that's the next block that we're doing, Zokef, Kufufim. So we're going to focus on that word, Zakef, which is Zayin, Kuf, Pei. Unfortunately, we don't have the charts in. And black words or white words here, but you're going to have to use your imagination, or your pencil and paper will work as well. So write that on your paper. If you have pencil and paper, write a Zayin and a Kuf and a Pei. That's okay. That's upright. Now let's have a look at those words and how they're composed, and we'll see some interesting Kabbalistic ideas here. Let's take the middle word, the middle letter, Kuf. That curve, the middle letter of that word is a kuf. What does the word kuf mean?
monkey. Kuf means a monkey.
So the middle letter, Kuf, means a monkey. But let's break that letter up and look at it a little bit more closely. That Kuf is made up of two letters. The way you write it in the Torah, it's made up of two letters. What are the two letters? It's not a red, no, well, not cross, if you're in your chest. It's a Kaf, right? A Kaf like a C, and a Vav. That forms a Kuf. A Kaf and a Vav. What is Kaf and Vav add up to? 26. Interesting, isn't it? Number 26? But here's the astonishing part. That word Kuf, if you were to write it out, how would you write it? You would write it Kuf, Vav, Peh. That's how you would write the word Kuf. So the letter Kuf spelled out is Kuf, Vav, Peh. That first letter, the Kuf, is made up of two other letters, a Chof and a Vav, which together constitute 26. And Kuf stands for Kurdish, for sanctity. The Kuf is a letter that represents sanctity. And broken up, that letter is 26, which is Hashem's name. What about the Vav, Peh? The rest of that letter. The Kuf is 26. What about the Vav and the Peh? How much are they? 86. Peh is 80 and Vav is 6. 86. What is 86? No, that's 28. That's 28. That wouldn't be that. We're talking about 86. 86, let's try this one. Elohim. Aleph is 1, Lamed is 30, that's 31. Vav is 6, that's 37. Hey is 5, that is 42. Good, and then am I counting out right? Am I counting out? No. Aleph, Lamed, Hey, good, men. So Aleph, Lamed, 31, is 36, isn't it? Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Hey, good, men. Should come to 86. So in that word Kuf, which means monkey, if you break it up, you have the two of God's names which we've been aligning in all our brachot. The Hashem, which is the internal God inside us, and the Elohim, which is our source of power, together forms the monkey. What does that mean? That sounds a little odd. I mean, careful is one thing, but this is a bit absurd. But there's some sense in that. Because the major is so absurd. In the time of Enosh, Medrash says in Medrash Rabba, in the time of Enosh they began to serve idolatry, and that was the time that people started looking like monkeys. You see, Darwin did have something right. There was a time when people looked like monkeys, but it wasn't the beginning of mankind. It was a little bit further down the line. We devolved into beings that looked like monkeys. We didn't used to look like monkeys. And the first you say, what changed? Why did we start looking like monkeys? Because humans lost the Tzelem Elohim. We think that that's an inalienable right. The Tzelem Elohim. We've created in God's image. Yes, we've created in God's image, but we can lose it. And when we lose it, we start looking like monkeys. A monkey is a human-like being that has no Tzelem Elohim. Real monkeys are created without Tzelem Elohim. Human monkeys lose their Tzelem Elohim somewhere along the way and turn themselves into monkeys. So some monkeys are made by God and some monkeys are made by people themselves. They're man-made monkeys. Just by losing our Tzelem Elohim, we begin to look like monkeys. It's not very difficult to understand that Medrash, is it? You just walk around outside with your eyes open and put your head in the background for a little while and look at people without preconceived ideas. Don't say these are humans, they're people. They will treat them with respect. Say, I don't know what they are, come from Mars. Come from Africa. Seen some apes around, seen some lions, seen some tigers. These are the first two-legged creatures I've seen. My, don't they look like apes? Isn't that what we would say? Sometimes they walk around the street eating like apes, sometimes they speak like apes, their mannerisms are like apes. We could be mistaken, we could be forgiven for mistaking them for apes. And that's what the Major says. When a human being ceases to act with majesty and dignity, he doesn't become an undignified human being. There's no such thing. There is majesty and there are apes. So
So when Darwin looked at people and said they come from apes, he's right.
But if Darwin would have looked at the Chofetz Chaim, he would not have said this man comes from an ape. That wouldn't have entered his mind as a possibility. The mind, if his knowledge of humanity would have come in its entirety from saintly people who had the image of God, it wouldn't have entered his mind to go seeking in the fossils of apes for some kind of human origin. And so there are different kinds of people. There are people who have a Tzelem Elohim and there are people who don't have a Tzelem Elohim. When we have a Tzelem Elohim, we are beings with majesty. But the world's constant battering of us to reduce us to the lowest common denominator means the pressure of society is to revert us to apes. That's really what society would like to see us all at. Because that way we're not embarrassing to one another. That way we don't establish standards for one another. That way we don't establish any sense of guilt or responsibility for one another if we're all on the same low standard. So there's a general gravitational pull in all societies, but in democratic societies more than anywhere else. The gravitational pull is not necessarily aspirational. The aspirational is to overcome gravity, make something of myself. The gravitational pull is just to be like everybody else, to be the same. Whatever that lowest common denominator is, ultimately it comes to some kind of an ape level. So that kuf in the middle of the word zakef is quite interesting. The kuf is a letter that contains within it both the essence of God, Hashem Elohim, and the meaning of an ape. Because the boundary line between divinity and apeliness, if there's such a word, there is one now, the boundary line between divinity and apeliness is a hair's breadth. It's not a long process of devolution. You can become an ape in a second. Just by being mindless for a second, just by losing the majesty for a second, one can become the ape. And so that letter kuf has within it the tension of human existence, the possibilities within the human being of being the most divine of beings. We said that the Chaim Volozhner's explanation from the Zohar of the human capacity to span from God's throne, from the force and the power above God's throne, all the way down to this earth, down to our body, to our flesh. Our soul is that massive expanse of universe. That's what we are. And we can move from one to the other in an instant. So in other words, there's no time bound between the two. I remember saying 11 months to Mars, but to God an instant. We're not talking about universal distance, we're talking about the capacity to move those distances in an instant, simultaneously virtually. Where we can be there and then a second later we can be here and we can be in both places at once. That's the human being, we're a kuf. We have kedusha, we have sanctity, and we're kufim, we're monkeys. Whether we express ourselves from the monkey perspective or the sanctity one depends on our core. Now let's look at the other two letters of this word, Zakeh. What about the Zion? How many dimensions are there in space? Four, six. Seven. Well, most people say three, as far as I know. And in space there are three dimensions. Which means six altogether. There are six directions, three dimensions. What about Zion? What is seven? Well, it depends. If you look at a cube, it depends from where you look at the cube. The secular world looks at the cube from the outside. If you look at a cube from the outside, it has six dimensions. If you look at a cube from the inside, it has seven dimensions. What's the seven?
The center.
The distance from the center to each of the edges. So that we move the Lilith in six different directions, the six directions in which we move the Lilith, northeast, north, south, east, west, up, down, those six directions represent seven dimensions, not six. Which is why we walk around, we do the Hakapotah, we do the Hakapotah, we're doing them seven times, not six. Because from a Torah perspective, from a Kabbalistic perspective, we talk of the world as having seven dimensions, not three, not six, not four, just space. I'm not even talking about time and the other things. I'm just talking about spatial dimensions. The six dimensions created by the three, or the six edges creates the six directions created by the three dimensions, and the seventh, which is the point right in the middle of the cube, that pnimiyut, that inside point, which represents the soul of the cube or the soul of space. Space has a soul too, the soul of the space.
is its seventh dimension, and that's what Zion is. Zion is 6 plus 1, Zion represents 7, it's the container plus its innermost point. That's the Zion. What about K? How do you form a K? Think of it as a K written in a Torah. A K is formed by an outside chof, right, again a kind of a C, and a yud inside. So the chof stands for kli. A chof stands for a vessel, a utensil. And the yud is the spiritual point inside. So chof also represents an outer container with something inside. If you take the inside away, it's not a chof. It's not a pe. If you take the outside away, it's a chof. If you put the yud inside, it becomes a pe. If you take the outside away and you only have the inside, it's yud. Yud is God. It's only the yud surrounded by the chof that creates the pe. And the pe is the combination, once again, of the outside and the inside. So if we take that zakeh, Zion, six dimensions, plus the inner one. Chof, an outer kli, plus an inner point. That determines the difference between the monkey and the divine being. Because if you've got a monkey, in the middle of whom is the 26 and the 86, God himself, that's no monkey. That's a human being. That's the proof. And that's what Zakeh means. Zakeh is one who stands upright, because they're operating from their core, not six dimensions, but seven. Not a chof, but a pe. Not a kof, meaning a monkey, but a kuf, which stands for tradition. They're all so close. Just take the center point out of the Zion, and it becomes a vol. Just take the yud out of the pe, and it becomes a chof. Just take God out of the monkey and it becomes a monkey. God out of the person and becomes a monkey. Take that inner core out and what you're left with is an empty shell that is nothing but an empty shell. And zakeh, that dignity, is when we're operating from the core. So what did you just say? It's so interesting how our physical gestures represent such an inner being. You said when you sat with dignity, that came from your core, from your spine, from your essence. That's what created that sense of dignity. That's what changed. Just as in our bodies, when we are in touch with our core, we manifest dignity. So in our total beings, when we're in touch with our core, we manifest majesty, we manifest dignity. It's interesting if we go just one step further in our playful dealing with the word zakeh, and we say, okay, that word pay, what does it mean? Does it put me in the monkey? What does a pay mean? A mouth. A mouth is used for speaking, and a mouth is also used for eating. What does Zion mean? Azana Sayulam, Kuleba Tzavor. Nourishment. So the Zion is nourishment, and the pay is speaking. When we talk about a pay, we usually talk about the organ of speech. So the mouth is represented both in the Zion and in the pay, and in different ways. There's the mouth as a source of nourishment, and the mouth as a form of expression. Now here's an interesting little thing that you might enjoy. What is the minimum you need to celebrate Shabbos? I know people think that you need a five-course meal, and you need a chant, and you need dessert. Let's get through. What do you need? Start at the beginning. Candles. You need lots. You need leather. You need bread. What else? You need wine. What else? You need basar, you need meat, and fish. So if you had a glass of wine, slice of challah, a little bit of meat, a little bit of fish, that's a Shabbos dinner. You don't need anything else. Okay, now let's have a look at those five elements. That's a Shabbos dinner. Take the candle. What is the word for candle? No. How much does that add up to? I think it's interesting to look at it there. What does no add up to? 250. 250. What is 2 plus 5 plus 0? 7. Let's try the next one. What about yad? How much is yad? Yud, yud, nun. 7. 7, 0. 7 plus 0 is? 7. Isn't that interesting? What about the next one? Chal. Ches, lamed, he. 38 plus 5? 33. 4 and 3. 7. How interesting. What about that? duck, fish. 4 plus 3, 7. Why do they all add up to 7? That's the human girls' comments, not mine. Why do they all, what makes them Shabbos? What makes those 5? What joins those 5? What makes those 5 Shabbos? So? Yeah, what gives them the holiness? What makes them? Kiddush. Kiddush is what joins them all together. You need to say Kiddush where the lights are, where the veil is present. You need wine for the Kiddush, and you need Kiddush b'mot and suri. So the words that you say, it's Shabbos today. There's reason for this. There's meaning for this. There's meaning in this meal. This isn't just sitting down to eat something. Because you can have very little meat, very little fish, one piece of challah, a glass of wine, and that's your meal. You don't need anything else. What you do need is conversation. What you do need is sanctity. Now what do we do at our Shabbos? Plenty to eat. And how do we rate on the sanctity? The time for about 10 an hour, who's what the kids learn at school, they learn the day, go through the sheets, and that's where, but where's the kiddush? Where's the new ideas? Where's the chiddush? Where's the excitement over a concept, over an idea, over a feeling of sanctity? That's the Shabbos meal, the rest is nothing. The rest is just to create that. And the rest is what, with the words, turns food into nourishment. That's what Zan means. Real Zan. Zan doesn't just mean eating. Zan means nourishing. Nourishing one in the deepest sense. So when the pay is used, when the pay is used on the food becomes nourishing, a Zayin, and the cock becomes a kuf. The monkey becomes a god. That's right. If we sit around the table eating these lavish meals with no sanctity, we're sophisticated monkeys. That's all. Monkeys are allowed to use a knife and fork. Sometimes. Sometimes not even that. But that's all we are. But if we eat a simple little plate of meat and fish and bread and wine, but there's kedusha. The way we sit with majesty. There's majesty around the table. There's tranquility. There's beautiful conversation. There's melodious meals. There's new thinking and new ideas. There's a kiddush sense said with a sense of meaning. That's no kof. That's a kuf. That's kedusha. And you know what? People will sit at the table differently. They'll sit with majesty and with dignity. They'll sit in thrones, not on benches. Because they'll feel dignified. They'll feel human. They'll feel majestic. And so we need to appreciate that the act of sitting or standing majestically, standing with dignity, is a form of affirmation. It sets the tone. It's not that we do that because we feel majestic. If you sit with dignity whenever you feel majestic, I'm sorry to tell you, it's not going to happen all that often. Because we don't feel that majestic all that often. But if you always sit with dignity and always walk majestically and always stand with presence, you know what? You'll feel majestic most of the time, but more than just feel majestic. And the Sefer HaKinuch says this really important phrase, which is so abused in its meaning. Acher hamasim nimshachos halavoros. The heart follows the action. So we think that means if you act from, you'll become religious. And so just do all the mitzvahs and everything else will follow. That's not what it means. What it means is if you bear yourself with dignity, you will experience majesty. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about the way, the posture with which you function, the way you move, the way you interface, the way you sit. That's what determines who you are at that particular time. It's not an expression of who you are. It creates who you are at that time. It is who you are. It is where you are. And that form of dignity and how much of this is taught, just another example of where the intersection between Eastern philosophies and our own original traditions, which we've lost so tragically. What is the thing that was taught in meditation? In yoga. That's the first thing they teach you. Not just how to sit. How to sit. Even before you breathe, they teach you to breathe. Before they teach you to breathe, how to sit. How to sit upright. And they laugh in the East because we Westerners find it very hard. Because we don't normally sit that way. We normally slouch. We don't normally sit it. Our postures, our bodies aren't used to it. Because we don't think of ourselves like that. And so we need to appreciate that when we sit with
with that kind of dignity and with that kind of majesty, we're not only affirming our majesty, we're radiating our majesty, we're broadcasting our majesty. And what happens when you radiate and you broadcast majesty? People respond in that way. Not just other people, the world responds in that way, because we're accessing that which is most innermost within ourselves. We're accessing that little dude inside the chof. We're accessing that little point inside the six dimensions of space. That's where we're operating from. Our thinking is from there, our being is from there, our decision making is from there. And that's when we're able to sit with a kuf, with an uprightness, and with a zakah, if we're able to sit with that kind of uprightness, as only humans can, not monkeys. Monkeys cannot sit on chairs in an upright way. Only humans can use a throne. Only humans can use a chair. That's the point at which we make ourselves in no way relatives of the monkey or the ape, but in fact majestically divine human beings. And that's our brother. Zekef Kefufim. As we're lying in bed and we're getting up, we affirm to ourselves before we even stand uprightness. This is about dignity and majesty. This is about Zekef. This is Zion. Kuf, Pei. That's what we're going to do. This is not lounging around and slouching around. This is Zion, Kuf, Pei. Before we get out of bed. And how do we know that it's before we get out of bed? Because look at the next breath, which we'll just do very briefly in a minute or two. That is the next breath, huh? Raka ha'aretz al hamayim. Thanking God for making the land firm. We'll come to that in a moment. But what does that mean? That means that's the breath you say when you stand. Which means when you said Zekef Kutufin, where were you? You are probably sitting upright in bed. So matirasurim, you release yourself, you now have energy. The next step is sit upright for a moment and pause there. Make sure you're sitting with dignity. When you've recovered your dignity, you're working from your core. Then, raka ha'atayim, put your foot down and stand. Now imagine as you do that, putting your foot down and standing, imagine it's your first time putting your foot down and standing. Imagine you've been lying in bed and Hashem has been up there in heaven and you've never been to this world before. And you learned a bit of Chumash when you were up there, and you know that the earth was made of water primarily, air and water, and there's a bit of sand in it, and it was a mushy hole. God could have left it covered in water, or He could have kind of created a dry land which could have been quite swampy. That would have been a natural thing to do. It was a mixture of sand and water, that's what the earth was made from, so the whole thing could have been a big swamp. It was miraculous, and those of you who are with me in the Bereshit series will remember, the way God contracted water in counter to nature in order to create dry land was completely miraculous. The normal situation would have been that we would have lived on muddy masses of ground. Now why do we say it roughly? Put your feet down and you know what? It's firm. That's amazing. It's firm. It's not muddy, it's not swampy. Why is that so important to us? Who cares if it's a little swampy? We'll put the fence down. Why is it so important to us that we say, Reka ha'asalamayim, the next block? You try walking with dignity on muddy water. You know, in the gyms sometimes they have those squashy balls you're supposed to stand and balance on. You know what I mean? Those ones you stand on and they go, those dirty kind of balls. Very hard to stand on them, isn't it? And try and stand with posture. Try and stand with dignity and see how long you last. You can't. Imagine people falling all over the place, slipping all over the place, sliding. Where's the majesty? The firmness of the earth was created only to allow a human being his dignity. That's why God miraculously dried out the dry land to make it firm and hard, that we could build a firm existence, we could connect to the world properly, we could feel the world. And again, one of the things they teach you in Eastern philosophy is what? What do you do with your feet? See that they're connected to the ground all the time. Feel the connection. If you're sitting in a chair, have your feet flat on the ground. If you're meditating in a chair instead of the lotus position, have your feet on the ground. Be connected. Because dignity requires a sense of firmness. I don't get shaken around. I can stand in one place. I can stand my ground. That's part of majesty. I'm struggling to keep my balance. Where's the majesty? That's why we laugh when people slip. And the immediate response is to laugh. It's so undignified. You see a person walking around in a tuxedo and he slips on a banana peel and he goes for a rail slide all over the place. The first thing is to laugh. It looks completely ridiculous. To see the prince dressed in his tuxedo can't walk straight. It looks funny. Because it's so incongruous. It is incongruous. If we have majesty, we have to be able to retain our balance. Balance is about core. But it's not only about core, it's also about firm territory. When you're on firm territory, and you have your core, you have a sense of balance. And we thank God for providing us with firm territory on which we can stand with dignity and majesty and live our day as a kuf in sanctity from an internal point of being and not like a kuf, a monkey who simply responds to whatever happens to blow his way. Those are the brachas we make as we get out of bed. Sitting up, Zekir Kifufim, Matir Asurim first, as we lying down, we release ourselves to be able to sit. We sit with dignity and majesty on the edge of our beds. And then we stand on the firm ground and say, wow, look how I can stand. Imagine the thrill. We take it for granted because we do it all the time. Imagine a young child for the first time gets up and learns how to balance and can stand, that sense of accomplishment. I'm an adult, I'm a real person, I can stand. I don't have to walk around on all fours anymore. It's a moment of celebration. And we have that moment of celebration each morning of our lives. Celebrate it, savor it, enjoy it. Don't let those moments pass. Enjoy those moments. Every single moment you have the opportunity to enjoy that feeling of being so in touch with our feet on the ground and our heads in Shemayim, with our souls attached to God's throne and to the earth at the same time. The only beings are majesty.